heard the president's voice on the call?
I didn't.
And you heard him raise that subject again that Ambassador Sondland had raised before about investigating the Bidens, right?
I didn't.
And I want to ask you, when you heard him say that, what was the first thought that went through your mind?
Frankly, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. It was probably an element of shock that maybe in certain regards, my worst fear of how our Ukraine policy could play out was playing out, and how this was likely to have significant implications for U.S. national security.
And you went immediately and you reported it, didn't you?
I did.
Why?
Because that was my duty.
New York Democratic Congressman Sean Maloney questioning National Security Council staffer Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman. Vindman was one of four officials who testified today in the impeachment inquiry. He listened in on Trump's July 25th phone call with the Ukrainian president. Joining me to talk about today's testimony is Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, have we learned anything new today, either from Vindman's testimony or from anyone else?
No, we really didn't hear anything new, but that in and of itself is interesting in the sense that what we got from these four witnesses is a story that's very consistent with the whistleblower complaint. What we got from these four witnesses so far is essentially corroboration of that complaint. What we've got from these witnesses is the idea that there is a narrative emerging of people who are both career members of the government and political appointees who were worried about the substance of this conversation between President Trump and President Zelensky.
Although this afternoon, Tim Morrison, who was the top Russia staffer at the NSC, he was on the call and he said he didn't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And there's a reason that he was called by the House Republicans. And so I think that, you know, what we're seeing here in terms of the substance of what we're going to fight about is whether or not people think that there was behavior by the president that just went beyond the bounds of what's acceptable and even legal, or whether or not this didn't really raise any red flags for people. I think what we're seeing here is the majority response is there was a problem, people were told to talk to lawyers, and people were kind of surprised, in the words of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, that he was very surprised that the president would bring up these issues of investigating Burisma and the Bidens, because it wasn't at all what he had prepared President Trump to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. I think the word that he used was improper when he heard that phone call.
Yes. And again, it's, you know, it's important to think about the fact that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman said, I'm not a partisan, I serve the country. And so despite the fact that I think House Republicans have provided a fairly consistent attack in the sense that they're attacking the process, they're attacking the person who's testifying, and or they're trying to distract to other behavior, what Lieutenant Vindman said today, I think, was quite damaging in the sense that I've worked in a number of administrations, I helped steer Ukrainian policy, and he was really taken aback by the substance of this phone call.
There was also an interesting exchange between Devin Nunes, the ranking minority leader on the committee, and Adam Schiff, the chairman, who both come from California, about exposing the whistleblower's identity when Nunes was questioning Vindman. Let's listen.
As you know, the intelligence community has 17 different agencies. What agency was this individual from?
If I could interject here, we don't want to use these proceedings.
It's our time,
I know,
Mr. Chair.
But we need to protect the whistleblower.
Please stop.
I want to make sure that there's no effort to out the whistleblower through the use of these proceedings.
Was that, in fact, what was happening?
Well, I think there was the possibility of that happening. People felt that, or at least Representative Schiff felt that if Lieutenant Colonel Vindman named the other person who he talked to, that even if that person might not be the whistleblower, presumably that person might have talked to the whistleblower and or would lead essentially a breadcrumbs trail to the whistleblower. And so it's interesting that we're still talking about this in the sense that there's a question about whether or not we need the whistleblower at all, because so much of that complaint, the vast majority, has been corroborated. On the other hand, so, you know, in a sense, it's, well, come forward or don't come forward. But I think what Representative Schiff is trying to do is say, we take whistleblower protection seriously. And so for the next person who might want to come forward, or the person after that, this federal law and this protection is still taken seriously by members of Congress.
And this afternoon, there was an interesting exchange with former special envoy Kurt Volker. Again, all of these people have testified before closed doors, and now they're testifying publicly. And he said that he, quote unquote, learned many things since giving his closed door testimony. And here's what he said.
In hindsight, I now understand that others saw the idea of investigating possible corruption involving the Ukrainian company Burisma as equivalent to investigating former Vice President Biden. I saw them as very different, the former being appropriate and unremarkable, the latter being unacceptable. In retrospect, I should have seen that connection differently, and had I done so, I would have raised my own objections.
So that's really interesting. He's saying that, yes, he was fine with looking into Burisma, but he didn't realize that that meant looking into Hunter Biden, which is either was very naive or maybe didn't want to know what he didn't want to know.
Absolutely. And in any case, that's a big difference, because in the first instance, what he's saying is, I thought it was appropriate to look into Burisma. We should look into the corruption in the Ukraine. That's perfectly fine. But what he's essentially saying now is, now that I know it meant looking into the family of a political opponent, I see that that's inappropriate. I would never have helped push the Ukrainian government to announce an investigation. So he's trying to basically reverse the story, in the sense that he's trying to take himself out of being one of the people to help President Trump to push for this investigation, saying, I just didn't have all the facts. Now, whether or not it's believable, I think it's very protective for him, but also very harmful for President Trump.
That's interesting, because he is one of the so-called three amigos. He, along with EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland and Energy Secretary Rick Perry, call themselves the three amigos. And others who are were working on a more traditional Ukrainian policy line basically said that they were operating this kind of underground diplomacy with Ukraine, these three amigos. So is Kurt Volker, do you think, trying to separate himself from that now?
Absolutely. I think he's trying to say, I didn't know a lot then. There would have just been two amigos. I wouldn't have participated. And he also is not making Rudy Giuliani look particularly good. So he's essentially saying Rudy Giuliani is peddling in conspiracy theories. I think he's very clearly trying to take himself out of that three amigo rubric, say, basically, I didn't understand what I was doing. I wouldn't have gone along with it. Rudy Giuliani is using irregular channels. It's not appropriate. And I think that this was, in many ways, a self-protective testimony. You have to wonder if House Republicans are happy that they called Kurt Volker.
Hmm. And tomorrow we're going to hear from EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland himself. He has already revised his testimony. So what can we expect?
Well, I think what we can expect is to hear from Ambassador Sondland, to try and hear what he thought of the particular phone conversation, whether he thought it was appropriate for President Trump to be asking for these investigations. And I think we're going to hear from both sides questioning his credibility, because he did have this revised testimony where he essentially said, yes, there was some sort of quid pro quo. It was going to be an investigation for military aid.
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School, and she's our regular legal. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, why Republicans are pushing the debunked conspiracy theory at the hearings that Ukraine was behind the 2016 election hacking. We'll have that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's try now to shed some light on some of the more unusual theories the Republicans are promoting in the impeachment hearings. Here's Congressman Devin Nunes questioning Alexander Vindman today on Hunter Biden's alleged dealings in Ukraine.
As you know, that financial records show a Ukrainian natural gas company, Burisma, routed more than $3 million to the American accounts tied to Hunter Biden.
I'm not aware of this fact.
Until recently.
I guess I didn't independently look into it. I'm just not aware of, what kind of payments Mr. Biden may have received. This is not something I'm aware of.
And what about some other ideas Nunes and the White House are pushing, such as Ukraine involved in hacking the 2016 election, a claim that has been debunked by the intelligence community, and that The Hill's journalist, John Solomon, knew about this the whole time. And who is he? Well, here to talk about all these ideas and where they came from is Mike Spies, reporter at ProPublica. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with Hunter Biden. And there were some allegations thrown out today about millions of dollars, trading hands. Tell us about his role in Burisma and why this has become conflated with what's going on right now on Capitol Hill.
Burisma is a natural gas company, the biggest natural gas company in Ukraine. And while Joe Biden was vice president, his son Hunter was hired to sit on Burisma's board and function as a paid board member, and took in like a fair amount of money from the company. Obviously, that's not an ideal situation and presents a clear conflict of interest and probably should have just never happened in the first place. However, what has grown out of that is a completely unsubstantiated claim that the vice president, while serving in his vice presidential role, interfered in an investigation in Ukraine to protect his son, which is to say he forced the Ukrainian administration at the time to remove the lead prosecutor in the country, which was looking into Burisma's activities. This is how the conspiracy goes, in order to keep his son out of trouble.
Devin Nunes today was talking about Hunter Biden and bringing him up and Joe Biden and whether or not Joe Biden got involved in the firing of the Ukrainian prosecutor that was looking into Burisma. And that, it seems to be also confusing, because that prosecutor was widely viewed as corrupt for other reasons. Right.
Right. The initiative to remove that prosecutor was not something that was being solely undertaken by the vice president. It was the agenda of the larger Western world that he be removed because he was considered corrupt by virtually everyone.
And what does that have to do with Burisma?
Nothing, to be honest, other than the fact the prosecutor had some interest in Burisma, which is a company that has had issues in Ukraine. Both things can be true at the same time. The vice president could have an interest in removing the prosecutor. That company can also have problems that the prosecutor may have been interested in. And then there's the unfortunate detail that the company's board member includes the vice president's son. Because his son was on the board, it's become like the sticking point for the Republican Party. That's the thing that they keep coming back to over and over again. There's this conflict of interest. All there is a conflict, and it's true. It's the appearance of a conflict, but there is nothing else beyond the appearance of a conflict.
Devin Nunes brought up a man named John Solomon, who was a columnist at The Hill, and I just want to play a clip from his statement talking about Solomon reporting on this very issue we just talked about.
Republicans have cited numerous indications of Ukraine meddling in the 2016 elections to oppose the Trump campaign. Many of these instances were reported, including the posting of many primary source documents by veteran investigative journalist John Solomon. Since the Democrats switched from Russia to Ukraine for their impeachment crusade, Solomon's reporting on Burisma, Hunter Biden, And Ukraine election meddling has become inconvenient for the Democratic narrative, and so the media is furiously smearing and libeling Solomon.
So tell us more about John Solomon and how he figures into all of this.
I mean, that is just, so I did hear that this morning, and I just want to like firmly state that that is an utterly outrageous thing to say. I mean, Solomon's columns are viewed as being so problematic that his own publication is now undertaking a review of them to possibly have to issue corrections, updates, annotations. So to back up, Solomon came to The Hill in 2017. For a long time, he's a veteran reporter. For a long time, he worked in establishment media, like at the Associated Press, even the Washington Post, where even there, he ran into some problems per some of the stuff he was putting out there. Over time, he migrated into like the right-wing media ecosphere from the Washington Times to a startup called Circa, and then to The Hill in 2017, where he came on as an executive and as somebody, to be clear, who was producing story under the banner of news. And then in 2018, almost a full year before his columns concerning the Bidens and Ukraine started to appear, had been reassigned, if you will, or his writing had been reassigned specifically to the opinion column because internal concerns had been raised about the approach of his work. And I suppose, you know, there are also concerns about the veracity of it, stuff like that. So he starts producing those columns in March of 2019. Per ProPublica's own reporting, we learned that at least got a better understanding of the circumstances surrounding those stories. And to be clear, they revolved specifically around a man who was at the time serving as the Ukrainian prosecutor, a man who is not a lawyer, by the way, and who has since lost that role. Solomon secured an interview with him in which he alleged several things that became a very big deal, one of which was that the ambassador recently testified, issued a do not prosecute list to him after he took office, a claim that he, even though Solomon seems to deny this, later retracted and said, no, she didn't give me a list. I asked if she had a list, which is a very different thing.
So John Solomon, so what is his connection to these two Rudy Giuliani associates, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman?
In this case, Lev is the more important one. Lev played a very important role in helping John Solomon put together his stories. Most importantly, he helped Mr. Solomon set up his key interview with the Ukrainian prosecutor who made news, especially in the conservative ecosystem, when he said that this ambassador had handed him this do not prosecute list, and also resurfaced concerns relating to Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and Burisma. Parnas also, according to Solomon, helped him with other matters. He occasionally, like, you know, he would help him with translating.
So was there a link between Lev Parnas, Rudy Giuliani and John Solomon? So in effect, I guess I'm wondering, yes, if Parnas and Giuliani were feeding John Solomon this information, hoping it would get out into the media.
I mean, based on what we reported that what others have reported too, that they were all working together. I mean, from Solomon's perspective, these were sources, and which is not entirely untrue, but every source has an agenda. You can get information from anybody so long as you can corroborate it, you know, in multiple ways from other sources. But this relationship and the stakes and considering what has played out, it doesn't have the spirit or feel like what would be a typical source journalist relationship.
And finally, let's talk about this woman that Nunes continues to raise. Her name is Alexandra Chalupa. Who is she? And he's basically saying she was a DNC Clinton campaign operative working in Ukraine. And what is the truth as far as we know?
I think the truth was she was trying to get information about Paul Manafort for a good reason, because I mean, it wasn't like that was happening in a vacuum. She was working as a Democratic operative at the time. So, I mean, it would make sense that she would be interested if Paul Manafort had engaged in illegal activities in Ukraine, there would obviously be a clear interest in her knowing about what he, you know, what that was.
And was this when he was campaign chair of the Trump campaign?
I believe so.
And so why is Devin Nunes raising her name now? What is he saying that she actually did in his mind?
She's just trying to make the argument that, like, this is the Democrats have been harping about Trump collusion with Russia, when in reality it was Democrats that have been colluding all along with Ukraine, which, of course, there's no like suggestion or evidence or anything like that, that anything untoward was happening there at all. It's just telling a different story. I mean, I guess that's what trials are, right? I mean, that's what the defense and the prosecution does. It's a battle of narratives. And I think Republicans have sort of very shrewdly homed in on that. And Nunes, being the leader, is going to push that narrative.
Well, Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Spies, he's a reporter at ProPublica. Coming up, billionaire Tom Steyer is running for president.
What we've seen is there have been mistakes. But if you say to me, who do I trust, the politicians or the people? I'm saying the people.
Why he wants to expand California's initiative process nationwide. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Now, another in our series of interviews with the many Democrats running for president in 2020. Today, Tom Steyer. Steyer made more than $1 billion running a San Francisco-based hedge fund before turning to philanthropy and liberal activism. Over the last 2 years, he's been running the PAC Need to Impeach, lobbying lawmakers to impeach President Trump. I sat down with Tom Steyer at the California Democratic Party State Convention in Long Beach over the weekend. Tom Steyer, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Why are you running for president?
I'm running for president for a very simple reason. Basically, I think I listened to the first few debates and I got in really late because I felt like no one was leveling with the American people. And the true story is, it's not a question about which Green New Deal we want. It's not a question about which healthcare, you know, change we want. It's not a question of which anti-gun violence program we want. The problem is we have a broken government.
And what's the basis for this broken government? What caused it to break?
Corporations bought it. So if you look and see, why do we have gun violence at a level that no other country in the world has? And that's whether you're talking about mass shootings, domestic violence, unsafe streets, or suicide. And the basics, the kind of thing that 90% of Americans want, which is mandatory background checks on every gun purchase, which has been true for a long time. Mm-hmm. Republicans, NRA members want it. We don't get it because actually the gun manufacturers control the NRA and they like to sell guns.
Okay.
And they don't want any limitation on that.
Right. And so if corporations bought candidates, is what you're saying, basically, is the answer, the only answer in your mind, for a billionaire to run for president?
Well, actually, I would put it differently, Madeline, and I'd put it this way.
Because you're self-funded.
Very largely, yes. But here's how I'd put it. If you think that the problem is that we have a broken government, it's been purchased by corporations, then I would ask, who can you trust to unbreak it? And that's really the question.
And
I've spent over a
decade. And we should trust you.
Yes, and I'll tell you why. I've spent over a decade doing just that. I started co-chairing the No on 23 campaign, taking on oil companies when they tried to roll back our environmental laws. No one else wanted the job. No one thought you could beat an oil company. They'd never been beaten. We got 70% of the vote. You probably remember Prop 56, mm-hmm. which I led in 2016, which was a $2 a pack cigarette tax. The cigarette companies had won 17 times in a row. They'd never lost. We won. The money went to fund Medi-Cal, the healthcare system for the lowest income Californians.
Mm-hmm. But all of these things could and have been fought for by people who are not wealthy or not as wealthy as you. Are you saying that you have a special avenue to de-corrupting the political process because you have the money to do so, because you don't have to take donations from
I think I have a special history of succeeding. I mean, if you really want to ask who is willing, who first of all, who's calling this out as the issue? Who's saying this is the issue? Who has a history of succeeding in doing it over a decade? As an outsider, do you want an outsider or an insider to unrig the game? And lastly, listen to what I'm saying.
We heard that from the current president.
I know, but he was lying. But let me say this too, Madeline. What he said was, and people voted for him because he said, the system's rigged. They're screwing you.
But this is also a message that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders run on. And other candidates also mention this. How is your message any different?
Several ways. Partly, I actually have a history of succeeding in doing this. Partially, if you listen to what I'm talking about doing, it's different. I'm saying I would put in term limits for congresspeople and senators of 12 years. No one else in this race will even say they're against that.
How would you do that? Wouldn't you have to get an amendment to the Constitution?
Well, let me tell you the other things I'm for, because that will answer some of your other questions. I am also for a federal referendum, a federal ability to do propositions the way we do propositions in California and 25 other states. 26 states have propositions. That if the legislature won't do it, you can get a certain number of signatures, put it on the ballot, people vote for it, it's the law.
So you think there should be a similar system nationally?
Yes, I do. Because I think
a lot of people don't like that system, and they point to, for example, Proposition 13 as the prime example.
Right. And, you know,
what or Prop 187.
What we've seen is there have been mistakes. But if you say to me, who do I trust, the politicians or the people? I'm saying the people.
A recent Los Angeles Times poll found that 95% of voters think homelessness is either a serious or a very serious problem. It is pretty much the number one issue for people in Los Angeles. There's not a lot of space or words devoted on your campaign website to homelessness. You don't talk a lot about it. What is your plan?
Well, first of all, just so you know, Madeline, I worked pretty hard on Prop H, which was to take to raise sales taxes in LA to spend money directly on homelessness. But I will say this, when I think about homelessness, and I know the numbers in LA and I've been multiple times down to Skid Row to see what it looks like and to talk to the people who are working there directly on the problem.
And you live in San Francisco, so you see
the
problem close
there. I see it at home, but I've also gone to LA because LA's, at least numerically, it's the biggest and it's got the biggest issue. What I see is a dramatic shortage in housing across the board, with the highest degree of problem and the most toxic aspect of that being homelessness. And so when I look at it, I look at a state where inequality is inseparable from housing. And this is the most toxic aspect of at least 2 million too few units as a result of policies that have been in place for over 40 years. And so when we talk about...
Some of those policies are also taxation and the tax code.
Totally. Agreed.
Do you think that...
A large part of them, by the way.
Yeah.
I know.
Which have advantaged you personally?
Look, if you look at Prop 13, if that's what you're referring to...
I'm referring to everything. You are a billionaire.
And you know something? I started a business. I built a business. I took the giving pledge. I walked away from my business. I said, I'll give more than half my money away for good causes while I'm alive. I've spent the last 7 years full-time traveling the country and organizing coalitions of people on a grassroots basis. So do I understand how lucky I am, and am I pushing to undo every Republican tax break for rich people and big corporations? Yes. Did I propose a wealth tax over a year ago? Yes.
Does it look like Elizabeth Warren's?
It actually, when I originally proposed it, it was started at a lower dollar amount and didn't have as high a rate. And I think I started a year ago and we're working on doing a much more granular one. But I think that way will stay that way. Start at a lower place and have lower rates. So
but
that's
why
what
lower?
I think. Because I think that what I think we're going to try and do is have something that I think as part of an entire tax plan undoes the unfairness, addresses inequality, and is fair.
Philosophically, I wonder if you think there is a moral argument that billionaires shouldn't exist.
Well, let me put it to you this way. I would change all the tax rules and undo them and make them much more progressive, including a wealth tax. I believe there's been a 40-year war on working people, and that that's been partially by going after unions specifically, but also you can see that in terms of where the money's gone, it's been dramatically unfair. But if you said to me that we should put a ceiling on what people get for creating, I would say no. I would say we should have a much more progressive tax code.
Like, what should the highest tax rate be, do
you think? You know, it's funny. You seem to think there's a specific number. I grew up in the 60s where I think it was definitely, I think it started at least with a 7.
Yeah.
And you know, and what is it
now? Up to a 9 in the 50s, I believe.
But it was also a much different code, to be fair. It was done in a completely different way, and people took a lot of deductions. I don't know. I wasn't alive then. I know that the marginal rates were much higher. I know that the way that people paid wasn't that different.
Why not take your considerable fortune and organizing ability and enthusiasm and put it behind one of the other candidates, a candidate that, quite frankly, has more of a chance to win?
Because I think I have a great chance to win. But it's more than that. I think I'm the only candidate in this race who will say that priority one is climate. Only one. I'm the person who says I would declare a state of emergency on day one and use the emergency powers of the presidency. I would do it from the standpoint of environmental justice, which I've always done. And I'm the only person who'd say I'd make it number one in terms of my foreign policy. Because it's not an American issue, it's a global issue. And if we're going to actually make this happen, it has to be with our leadership around the world. But if you
so
believe,
you're different than what Bernie Sanders has proposed
completely
with
different.
His new climate proposal.
That proposal has to be passed by the Congress of the United States.
And yours wouldn't?
Emergency powers of the presidency.
So executive order.
Yes. Not one.
But then that could be undone by the next president.
You know something? We have a problem. You're absolutely right. My point is, we don't have time to wait.
Polling, though, shows that most Americans put health care as one of their top issues. What would you do about that? Do you believe in single payer, Medicare for all?
What I believe in is that affordable health care is a right for every American. And I also believe we have to use the power of the United States government to drive down the cost. I would choose a public option for the following reason, as opposed to Medicare for all. First of all, I think there are 160 million Americans who get their health care through their employer. A lot of them are union workers who've negotiated for it. If we can make the public option so cheap and good that they go to their employers and say to them, you give us the money you're spending on our health care, we'll go buy the public option. Great. But it's a choice.
So that sounds like Kamala Harris's plan or Pete Buttigieg's plan.
What it is basically you get it. We're going to come out with a full plan so it's exact, but just so you know, it means everybody gets health care. You're automatically signed up. But if we're not trashing the existing system that's been there for 75 years, but everybody has a choice. I think this is both the freest in terms of giving people choice and the safest, the least risky way to do it. And that's why I'm for it. And I've thought about it.
President Obama has waded into the presidential campaign in a speech he gave recently where he said he basically warned Democrats that he was speaking to a room full of wealthy donors, not to get too ahead of their skis when it comes to blowing up the system. And it seemed like a veiled warning not to go too much in the Sanders-Warren direction, that the rest of America, the voters, are not necessarily behind that vision. They're not necessarily as left as the left wing of the party. Do you agree with him?
I honestly think we're misdiagnosing this issue. I think on most things I'm very progressive. But to me, it's a question of telling the truth, not being progressive. Like, you know, I was sitting here talking to you about climate. I'm not doing that because I'm a progressive. I'm doing that because that's what the facts dictate. If I stand up for...
But there are different methods, right? There's the blow it up and just...
Well, let me put it to you this way.
Tinker with what you have and make that better.
But this isn't a tinkering. Here's my point. Look, do I think we need to get rid of the private sector? No. I know that we're going to be much better off if we have a competitive, innovative, dynamic private sector that spurs growth. Do I think that the company should be allowed to write the laws under which they operate? No, that's absolutely wrong. And that's absolutely what's happening. And so is it progressive to tell the truth? I mean, I think we've gotten away from truth. And that's why I'm running. I mean, seriously, there's something broken in this system. And so we've got to break their power.
So you think the oil companies should go out of business? Or?
No, no, but they shouldn't be determining how we generate energy. And they shouldn't be determining what they pay the people who work in their gas stations.
When do we need to be off fossil fuels?
When you look realistically in where we can get to different places, 2045, we've got to be carbon neutral as a society. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be rolling thunder getting there. We just need to make it happen. The transportation stuff, you can see the car companies pushing back. Look, we have to do this, but we can do it. I mean, when people say, oh, it's, you know, it's too big, it's not too big, but everything's too big that you don't start on.
Tom Steyer, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. What a treat.
That was Tom Steyer, one of the 17 Democrats running for president in 2020. Coming up, The Report, a new movie starring Adam Driver about an investigation into torture during the Bush administration's war on terror. We'll have that next for you on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Abu Ghraib, CIA black sites, waterboarding. Those became household terms during the Bush administration and the war on terror, but we didn't really know what was going on behind the scenes. Sure, the administration eventually admitted to quote-unquote enhanced interrogation techniques, a.k.a. torture, and terrorists like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Abu Zubaydah, well, they may never go to trial because they were the subjects of these enhanced interrogation techniques. In 2014, after more than 5 years of exhaustive, painstaking research, the Senate Intelligence Committee, led by Senator Dianne Feinstein, finally revealed the findings of its so-called torture report.
There are those who will seize upon the report and say, see what the Americans did? And they will try to use it to justify evil actions or incite more violence. We can't prevent that. But history will judge us by our commitment to a just society governed by law and the willingness to face an ugly truth and say never again.
Well, a 500-page summary was released, but the full report remains classified to this day. Senator Feinstein is played by Annette Bening in a new movie dramatizing the release of that report. The movie is called The Report, and the film's writer and director, Scott Z. Burns, is with me in the studio now. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, it's great to have you. All right, so this centers on one of Senator Feinstein's staffers, and this is a guy named Daniel Jones, played by Adam Driver. Most people probably have no idea who this guy is. Tell us a little bit about him.
Daniel Jones was a Senate staffer who, prior to that, had done Teach for America right after college, and then he went to graduate school at Harvard. His second day of grad school was 9/11, and after that, he decided that he wanted to make the focus of his studies international relations. He came to the Hill, and he met with Dennis McDonough, who at that time was Tom Daschle's chief of staff.
And became President Obama's chief of staff.
Later. Yeah. But Dennis McDonough instructed Dan to go work at the FBI or the CIA and get real-world experience of counterterrorism. And so Daniel worked at the FBI doing counterterrorism. And then he came back to the Hill and became a staffer on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
And then Senator Feinstein said, you are going to be the one who's going to do this investigation. Because why? Did we not have an idea, or did they not have an idea of what actually was happening?
Well, it started with the revelation that the CIA had taped a number of interrogations very early on in the program. And when the committee became aware that there were tapes, they asked to see them. The CIA promptly destroyed those tapes. What ended up happening was Dan was given the task by Senator Feinstein and by the Intelligence Committee to go find out what was on the tapes because the CIA had kept written records as well. And based on what Daniel found in that 2-year study of the destruction of the tapes, the committee voted 14-1 for him to go further and do kind of a deep dive and an analysis of the entire program.
So he really took a deep dive. He got really into it. I mean, as you portray it in the movie, to the exclusion of all else.
Like, yeah.
No girlfriend, no life outside of being in this secured location and reading CIA documents and putting together this report.
Yeah, he worked in a windowless room for years and years. He looked at 6.2 million documents and basically assemble a timeline and give us the story of the genesis and evolution of this enhanced interrogation program.
And as you portray it, or as Adam Driver portrays it, not a lot came out of that.
As far as we can tell, everything they attribute to EITs they already had, from other sources, from foreign governments, from other methods. They claim they saved lives, but what they really did was make it impossible to prosecute a mass murderer like KSM, because if what we did to him ever came out in a court of law, the case is over. The guy planned 9/11, and instead of going to jail for the rest of his life, the CIA turned him into a recruiting tool for a war we're still fighting.
Okay, so that's pretty much true. Yeah. He will never see the light of day.
Yeah, one of the things that's been really fascinating and rewarding about telling this story are the people who have kind of come to us through the movie. And one of the groups that I think is the most interesting is a 9/11 survivors group. And they are irate that these torture techniques were done in their name, because it's so often cited that, you know, after what was done to us, you know, that we need to do this. And so there's a lot of outrage, because Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is generally considered the mastermind of 9/11, you know, it's impossible for us to really bring him to trial and give him due process, because torture is against the law.
Can you describe what those techniques were?
I mean, they run the range of things like sleep deprivation, which was accomplished by blasting loud music at people, to a thing called the facial slap. There are things called stress positions, which frequently meant chaining somebody to a wall or short shackling them to a bolt in the floor. The most notorious one, obviously, is the waterboard, which is basically simulated drowning.
Which was performed on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed over 180 times.
Yes.
You dramatize some of these techniques, or yeah, some of these torture scenes in the movie. They're very hard to watch. I'm not going to play a clip of them, because I think for listeners, it's a little too shocking to hear. But you can imagine. And I guess I'm wondering how you imagined it, because, again, the tapes were destroyed.
Yeah.
Did you get that information from the written record, from the report?
Sure. Well, initially, I actually had really thought that I wouldn't include any sort of visual representation of these techniques in the movie, because it is hard to watch. And when I was doing my research, I spoke to Alberto Mora, who was the general counsel for the Navy at the Pentagon when this program was being conducted. And again, one of the fascinating revelations for me in the research was to hear how people in the military were really devastated by the fact that the CIA went down this road. And Alberto Mora asked me the same question, and he said, are you going to show these things? And I said that I was sort of two minds about it. And he said, if you don't show it, aren't you just sort of perpetuating the original sin of the CIA? Because they didn't want to show it, because it is so visually powerful. And working in film and working in a visual medium, you're very aware of the fact that it's different to say the word waterboarding than to see what that looks like to do to another human being who's tied down, who's scared. And, you know, ultimately for me, you know, John McCain made a great speech about this on the day the report came out.
But in the end, torture's failure to serve its intended purpose isn't the main reason to oppose its use.
And what he said was, it's what it says about us. It's not what it says about our enemies. It's what it says
about us. It's about who we were, who we are, and who we aspire to be. It's about how we represent ourselves to the world.
And so even in the shooting of these scenes, I've tried to emphasize the role of the people who are doing the torturing, not the tortured.
So this whole big report comes out during the Obama administration. Obama, who campaigned on closing Guantanamo, of ending these techniques, like pretty much in the first month of his office, right? He just said, this is done. We're not doing this again. But he doesn't allow the report to be released. Why?
Well, that's a better question for him than for me. But I think my surmise is that, you know, he had run on a campaign of being postpartisan, and that he felt that going after a Bush-era program was going to just reflect negatively on his pronouncement that we should turn the page. And again, I think, you know, what I was trying to get across in the movie is that before we go too far into the whole world of right and left, we should really just sort of stick with right and wrong. And this program strikes me and people in the military as wrong and unsuccessful. It was ineffective. And President Obama said, you know, it looks like we tortured some folks. And we all remember that speech. But the next thing he said is, let's not get sanctimonious because the people who worked in this program are patriots. And to me, that's a problem that we have in this country that continues to this day in terms of, do we ever hold anybody accountable for what they do?
So nobody was prosecuted
No.
from the CIA or any of these contractors who carried Yeah. out some of these torturings. And the person who was overseeing these CIA black sites, Gina Haspel, is now the CIA director.
Correct.
In your movie, John Brennan, who was running the CIA at the time, doesn't come off well.
No.
He's trying to obfuscate, trying to get this report redacted or at least never see the light of day, get the CIA's point of view in there. And it's ironic that now he is in the news again on the other side, right? He's a never Trumper. Donald Trump calls him out, and Donald Trump is in the mess that he's in right now because of a CIA whistleblower.
Yeah, again, I look at this and think about right and wrong versus left and right. John Brennan is a challenging figure, I think, for all of us. And part of, I think, adulthood is realizing that these people are not all good or all bad.
Right. But I wonder if there is something there with President Trump's suspicion, deep suspicion of the intelligence community, including the CIA, with regards to Russian interference in the election,
sure.
with Ukraine, all of it. If that has some seeds in what you're talking about, that there is a mistrust that has been long brewing
yeah.
about the CIA and its methods.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, going back to John Brennan, this is a guy who spent, you know, I think something like 20 some years at the CIA, maybe longer. And for him, these accusations about this program must have seemed existential. You want to defend what you did, and you want to defend the actions of these people, because what the program really ended up using as its legal basis was, if it saves lives, then it's legal. And so they needed to prove, to protect their own, that they saved lives. So I understand from the point of view of a company man that John Brennan was saying what he was saying then. And I don't find that inconsistent with what he's saying now. It does seem, according to the FBI, that there was Russian interference in the election. And I don't think that that's politicized because it's been confirmed by other intelligence services mm-hmm. around the world.
Right. And so I guess in the final analysis, the report doesn't come out, but there is the 500-page summary.
Sure.
Is there more that we should know that we don't know because this report has been classified?
I've asked Daniel Jones that question over the years when I've been working on the script. And obviously, Dan can't tell me anything beyond what's in the 500-page summary, and he can't tell me what's behind the redactions. But when I've asked him if, you know, his regrets about his own editing of himself, what he'll say is really interesting, that it's the things that never made it into the 6,700 pages, the things that wound up on his cutting room floor, that bother him the most. And he obviously can't tell me what those are, but listening to him speak about them and feeling his tone change, I know he made some very difficult decisions because those things are lost to history. It's important to note that after Richard Burr took over from Senator Feinstein as head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he asked for all of the copies of the report back in an effort to sort of remove this piece of history. And there are, I think, only three that still exist. One in Barack Obama's presidential library, and I believe the other two are down in Guantanamo that are meant to be used by the people who are running those military commissions. And so, you know, I think for Daniel, it's a real fear that this will get lost to history?
Well, it is a fascinating chapter in our history, for sure.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you so much for bringing it to light. Scott Burns, writer and director of the new film, The Report, in theaters now and coming to Amazon Prime on November 29th. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And that will do it for us here at Press Play. You can download or subscribe to our podcast, listen whenever, wherever you want. Just go to kcrw.com/pressplay. Have a great afternoon, evening, whatever you plan to do with the rest of your hours of today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.